Hello and welcome to the Echo Chamber Podcast. My name is Tony Groves and today we're talking Safe Passage. As always, I'm joined by my co-host, Martin, the original nobody's child, McMahon. Martin, you do look like a baby.
Thanks very much, Tony. It takes years to keep this youthful look alive. just while we have a moment, look, we need more patrons. This pod is always a month from going under. The more patrons we get, the longer we can extend that time. Sign up, become a patron for the price of a cup of coffee. Thank you.
Anyway, much more importantly, we're delighted to be joined in the Tortoise Shack by educator, trainee psychotherapist, feminist and parent, really into refugee rights, campaigner of social justice, and, as I said earlier, an activist around the Safe Passage movement in Ireland, Caoimhe Butterley. Caoimhe, thank you so much. Finally, we got you in.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, first of all, I know you had problems finding the bloody place, so sorry about that.
Not at all.
Look, I'm going to go get straight into it. Do you want to just give the listeners an idea of what you guys have been doing in terms of the wider movement for refugee rights and the Safe Passage idea?
So I'm one of many, obviously, I think, of folks across Europe and many other parts of the world who have tried to respond in many ways to the inaction of our governments and also to the outsourcing of a lot of Europe's borders sort of into the sea, into the Mediterranean, Aegean seas. And in the last few years, there's been a mobilization on very much a community sort of grassroots based level of people from lots of different walks of life who have tried to both challenge policies that are condemning people to completely preventable deaths, the tens of thousands of women, men and children who have died at sea trying to seek refuge in Europe, but who have also tried to respond to the very practical needs of people making that journey. And those needs are medical and legal and oftentimes obviously emotional and psychological as well, and meaning-making. So we've been trying to both mobilize people to represent an alternative face of our countries in the sense of really challenging the injustice of a lot of asylum processes and the very devastating impacts that those policies have on people's lives, whether that's the very overt risk of potential death or injury in making the journey, but also, as we've witnessed in Ireland, the deeply disempowering, dehumanizing process of people who are forced to live through the limbo of direct provision. And direct provision is one of many examples throughout Europe of asylum processes that are humiliating, and that really deny people their most fundamental rights, both under international humanitarian law, refugee law, but also just a right, you know, to be able to live a life of meaning, and justice, you know, and for people who have survived so much with such courage, you know, and bravery and strength to be able to rebuild lives.
Yeah. I suppose the most shocking thing you said there to me now was the outsourcing of our human rights responsibilities to the Mediterranean Sea.
And to the Libyan, Libyan
is,
government and
that
Coast Guard.
We've done that. We've spoken to so many MEP candidates going to Europe, and we're talking to them about the idea around Fortress Europe and what the hell we're going to do about it, and how we can't sit here and pretend that we're not all aware of this, that we've outsourced these things to camps in Turkey and camps in Libya, you know, sending the boats back and then just leaving people, unfortunately, to drown.
Yeah.
I mean, it really is that serious. However, to go to domestically, you mentioned direct provision. I know you've worked with the people in Massey and the likes of that as well. Is there a sense now, do you find a sense, and we do because we live in our bubble, we try to push it, but do you find a sense that people are actually starting to wake up to the fact that Ireland has a part to play and needs to step up to the plate?
Yeah, on some levels, definitely. There's a lot more attention and focus on the injustice of direct provision, I think, than there has been for many of the years that has preceded, you know, the last couple. However, I think, you know, on a community level, there's been a lot of mobilization. You know, there have been, you know, the High Court challenges, the right to work sort of process, etc. But I think the sort of the key is translating a lot of that enormously effective, you know, really profoundly brilliant on many levels, but self-organization that is going on from movements like Massey into policy change. And so I sort of struggle between, you know, are we overestimating the reach and the impact of the work just because it's got more visibility? And is that actually challenging, you know, sort of the bureaucrats and the technocrats, you know, within power that are continuing, you know, to oversee a system that has, you know, been found by numerous international bodies as being in contravention of people's mm-hmm. rights. So I think there is a critical mass building, and that's amazing. But I wouldn't underestimate too, I think, the fact that it's going to take a lot more work and a lot more struggle, really, you know, for the abolition or for the end of direct provision. And also in the interim, the really devastating impacts that system is having on people. Before I came here, actually, I was in the Botanical Gardens with a group of mainly survivors of torture, you know, who are accessing services through Spirazi. And it was just really brought home to me again, you know, that you have communities of highly resilient, highly, you know, they're survivors, but also highly vulnerable women, men, and children who have survived Libya, you know, survived mm-hmm. the systematic human rights violations, gender-based sexual violence, you know, torture, slavery that is well documented and well publicized that is happening in Libya, you know, financed by the EU. Yeah. But then you have people, you know, who survived contexts of dislocation and war and conflict and persecution from so many different geographical origins, who, while we're struggling for the abolition of the system, are still waking up in it, you know, day after day, week after week, month after month. And I would say, you know, years potentially. It is a long struggle. And Massey have been doing amazing work around it. But I think it's really the responsibility of all of us, you know, who call ourselves allies to really up that ante in the sense of really, you know, systematically challenging policies, you know, whose impacts, you know, I think we're only beginning to see, you know, with a lot of the recent focus in terms of the impact on, you know, particularly child mental health and well-being, and a lot of the really gendered realities, you know, with NDP and the precarity and, you know, yeah, a big crisis, I think, in terms also of depression and self-harming, and which is completely understandable when you look at a context where people aren't receiving the most basic of support. Certainly trauma survivors, you know, all of the services that provide support to them are under-resourced and underfunded. And then on top of that, you know, a system which humiliates daily. And that is a word that I've used, or that I've heard articulated and used in so many different contexts, you know, just the word humiliation. And that's a really heavy load to carry. You know, I think people can put up in a way with, you know, physical or, you know, not having sometimes access to sort of practical comfort. But when you have a process where your very being is sort of negated and doubted, and you have to performatively prove your torture and your trauma over and over and over again, you know, with it's profoundly humiliating. And yeah, I think people who survive it have so much to teach us in the sense of resilience, you know,
I remember speaking to JP Swain, who was one of the founders of Blue Monday, about, you know, and we went off topic, but he was very, very definite about the issues that we're going to be dealing with in years to come, from direct provision centres, from children in homeless hubs, or whatever the equivalent is. You know,
and there's so much crossover in those two experiences.
Absolutely, yeah. And that's my point. But his point, which was key, was as a psychotherapist and as a person who was dedicated most of his life to these things, we can't say we don't know.
Yeah,
we do know. Like, yeah, we absolutely are aware of the crisis and, as you said, the denying of human rights and its very basic form, you know, denying people human dignity, the right to dignity.
Yeah, yeah.
And then re-traumatizing them. You know, I'm sorry for going off on one, but it just brought me to that space, because I remember speaking to him and he said, well, he deal with these children, and it will be 10 years from now where a Taoiseach will stand up and say, we're very sorry.
Yeah.
And everybody will say, oh, we'll pay them recompense, or we'll pay them, you know.
But it's a continuum that has existed in this country from year to
institutionalization. Off. Yeah.
Of course, we had Mary McAuliffe in, and Mary quite succinctly, and she said, we warehouse our poor.
Yeah.
And we warehouse them institutions.
Yeah.
It has gone on forever. And I'm completely at a loss to understand why the generations who exist now don't see the correlation with what happened in the past. That they don't see it as a continuum. They see it as something separate. And when it's exactly the same thing. I mean, there may not be laundries attached to direct provision or to homeless hubs, but the people within them are the commodity now. Yeah. They have become the commodity. It's all about making money. The idea that there are multimillionaires and millionaires in charge of these
making
people's
huge
lives
profit.
With arbitrary rules and no oversight. And that the government has outsourced this to basically to millionaires. You take care of the refugees, whatever way you feel like it.
Well,
and no oversight.
Dehumanizing and cutting, profit or corners to make profit, definitely. And that continuum of the carceral state and that institutionalization, which is very classed and gendered. It's interesting. I find too, as somebody who was born in Ireland, but my parents immigrated when I was very young, and then I spent my entire formative life outside of Ireland and then coming back into it. But that insider outsider sort of relationship with the country, you know, of seeing, you know, that pain and that trauma historically, intergenerationally, in that lived experience, certainly of the laundries, you know, and other forms, particularly around mental health and, you know, around women in general. But then, that lack of recognition of the total commonality in terms of conditions. And I think, as you mentioned, that's probably something long term, you know, that people will look back, you know, with perspective to be able to understand. But I'd say part of that, you know, is racism and is othering and is lack of, you know, and it's not to say, because I've traveled around a lot of, you know, sort of rural Ireland and a lot of different communities. I think there is a potentiality, you know, of empathy and a potentiality of hospitality and solidarity. But I think we also shouldn't underestimate, you know, as you guys obviously are very aware of, but that rise in, you know, an extremely racist right wing, you know, discourse, even if that's for now confined to sort of online forms.
Fear spreads faster than solidarity.
Yeah.
I mean, it's easier to sow that idea of the other.
Othering.
And that is like.
Sometimes fear and sometimes but supremacy and arrogance and
absolutely. But it's a heady cocktail and it's not just in Ireland. We've seen it across Western democracies, for want of a better phraseology. But I suppose I also want to talk about the hope. Like, you work with a lot of young people and you see a lot of activism and you see
without
a lot
a doubt.
Of do you want to just give us a flavor of why we should be more optimistic?
the antidote. It's interesting because I find when I was walking here actually in the rain and sort of the overhanging great cloud and questioning life choices instead of being here as opposed to in Khartoum or Sudan or, you know, participating and trying to support people in what's going on or elsewhere, but I keep that hope alive by my daily work, which is with children and around sort of critical development education and critical development or global citizenship sort of education. But they're amazing. And I have the luxury in a way of focusing on a lot of sort of human rights and social justice based content with them or curricula. And they are just so profoundly empathetic and critically engaged and politicized and really confident, I think, in their vision and understanding of injustice in the world. And some of that definitely is focused on climate change, you know, which is super important. But I think they're really extending that into a really intersectional understanding of justice. And a lot of them take inspiration from the young people in the States, you know, in the March for Our Lives, who marched against gun violence. And, you know, they take inspiration, you know, from gender equality movements across the world, you know, from young activists that they can see themselves reflected in. So whenever I sort of look at the cynicism and the brutality, you know, of policies that adults are enacting that's so devastatingly impact on the lives of the communities that I work with, that all of us work with. I do try and hold that space for hope. And it's certainly something I think in relation to what we were discussing earlier in the sense of Sudan and a lot of other contexts, you know, a lot of these movements for, you know, really profound societal change, you know, whether those are sort of pro-democracy or anti-dictatorship movements or, you know, movements that look at, you know, a whole myriad of different issues. But they're really being driven by young people. And oftentimes I think their emotional intelligence when it comes to their inner processes and their inner lives is a lot more nuanced than sometimes what I find in older populations of just that emotional, conservatives sometimes, or that emotional deflection when it comes to sort of going deeper and talking about pain or vulnerability. And the children, I find the kids that I'm working with, the young people that I'm working with have a really cohesive, you know, very eloquent, ability to talk about, you know, mental health struggles and emotional well-being and mental well-being. And so there's a literacy, I think, that is partially down to it. It's more common, you know, in sort of schools now for things like depression and anxiety to be mapped. but they very much relate that, you know, to the material conditions of the world that they're living in. And so they talk about class inequality, they talk about classism, they talk about racism, you know, they talk about sexism, and but they also relate that back, you know, and climate change, they relate that back to their anxiety. And I think that is so healthy, you know, not to almost silo or compartmentalize, you know, a lot of existential struggles that people are having, you know, from social struggle, from politics, you know, from injustice, because it's all so obviously interrelated. But I think they get that in a way that a lot of adults don't get. So that gives me a lot of hope in the sense of this next generation, because they have that profound empathy with each other. And I see that daily, you know, because inevitably, you know, the homelessness crisis, the housing crisis, you know, comes up, and whether it's invisibilized homelessness or, you know, actual homelessness, almost every class that I'd work with, depending on the school and, you know, the socio, you know, economic, you know, yeah, sort of zone of that school, but they have lived experience, you know, of precarity and of that vulnerability. But the reactions of the children in classroom settings is just so beautiful to witness, because they hold each other emotionally in a way that I think is really intuitive and really important. Anyways, young people are my thing these days, because it's like the daily dose of hope. And I think for whatever, you know, whatever we're seeing in terms of the consolidation of so much deep injustice and brutality and violence and discrimination and conflict and othering all over the world, I also think that there is this counterforce of enormously, you know, really activated, really confident young people who are fighting, you know, in a way that they recognize how high the stakes are, you know, for their rights and the rights of others. And I think they have something to teach adults, because oftentimes when I hear, you know, and I'm part of the climate change, you know, climate justice movement, or, you know, climate crisis movement, but there is also something that I find very white and middle class about it, you know, in the sense of it's always sort of oftentimes articulated about, you know, we're fighting for our children. We're not actually fighting for our children. Our children comparatively will be fine, you know, for now. We're fighting for the children, you know, of people of color, black and brown communities in other parts of the world who are not fine because of how we live and because of, you know, the choices that we make. So something that shifts that discourse into only being able to expend empathy when it comes to, you know, our children, you know, the kids themselves, they have that empathy, you know, with their peer-to-peer groups all over the world. And they recognize, like, when they talk about climate change or climate crisis, certainly in the workshops that I facilitate, they're not talking about themselves. They're talking about, you know, kids in Mozambique that they see, you know, responding to, like, these catastrophic weather events. You know, they talk about, you know, kids that they can see in dinghies crossing the Mediterranean. And they can really, in a way that I find amazing, put themselves in their shoes, like, to the point that oftentimes I sort of, when we're talking about, you know, the precarity that refugee communities face, when I talk about practical things, they go into the existential, they go into, like, processes. Like, I, you know, I ask them, what do you think people, if you could only bring a backpack with you, what would you bring? What of your life, you know, would you condense down into the small backpack that's going to stay on your back, that's going to get heavier and heavier the more you walk, you know, like a lot of the kids that I refer to, the kids that I work with who originate from Darfur and Eritrea and Ethiopia, you know, who have made that journey through the Sahara, you know, across the Mediterranean, survived and survived and survived. But these children here, like in Ireland, they oftentimes, when I ask them what's in their backpack, they'll start out with the practical stuff, you know, and they'll talk about, like, compasses and, you know, sleeping bags and, you know, and a knife, you know, in case you have to defend yourself, and matches. And then they go into things like, I was in a class the other day and the 11-year-old said you'd carry your trauma. And another said you'd carry your memories, and another said you'd carry your pain. Like, you know, they get this. They get it on, yeah, just this really deep level. And I think there's so much potentiality to build that level of consciousness and to fault, you know, to really bolster it. And for that to happen, adults need to step aside. Because I think we've really colonized and dominated that space for far too long within our social movements, within activism, and to invite, you know, in youth, not in a tokenistic way, but in a way in which, you know, there's recognition that our role is, you know, to accompany and to walk beside and to try and pass on maybe some of the lessons that we have of social justice organizing, but not to dominate that space, you know, because the time is theirs. And
Well, we often talk about structural violence here, and we often talk about structural violence. And it's a difficult concept. I find it a difficult concept to sell to grown-ups. Whereas kids who are more connected globally than the generations that went previously, it's not difficult to sell them the concept of structural violence.
Yeah.
You know, and it's not a concept, it's a reality. When you lock people away in Libya so that they can't cross the Mediterranean and the EU is paying for it, that's a perfect example of structural violence.
Yeah.
It's a perfect example of it.
Yeah.
It's governments working together to be violent towards people.
Without a doubt. Yeah. And in a way, I think in Ireland, we have this, sometimes I think this sense, you know, of being in and being out of the EU, you know, this island nation and, you know, with obviously, you know, an anti-colonial struggle and a post-colonial reality, but in a way, you know, Ireland is completely complicit in that structural violence, completely complicit, you know, in a decision to withdraw the search and rescue mandate, you know, from Navy ships that were saving lives, completely complicit in that outsourcing, you know, of violence to whether it's the Libyan Coast Guard, you know, or those who are held in detention centers, and completely complicit in the deaths, the necessary deaths of tens of thousands of people at sea. And in a way that's where I sort of feel this, you know, the cognitive dissonance of, you know, it is a country that, yes, punches above its weight on an international level when it comes to a discourse around human rights and, you know, humanitarian intervention. And yeah, you know, in my work, I lived and worked in Latin America, Palestine, Iraq, Lebanon, and different parts of Africa for about 20 years, you know, and I have seen, you know, amazing examples of that. But simultaneously, you know, institutionalization in terms of direct provision, simultaneously, the structural violence, you know, of the homelessness, of the housing crisis, simultaneously participating in an EU, which is profoundly complicit, you know, in violations of so many international laws when it comes to complete, you know, negation of refugee rights and the rights of those seeking asylum, of asylum seekers, rights of undocumented communities, the rights of migrant communities. So I think in a way I always find, and this is what Massey does so effectively and so deeply in terms of trying to draw those connections, you know, that what is happening here is it's specific to Ireland, but it's also symptomatic, you know, of a far deeper malaise within Europe of that outsourcing, you know, of that violence. And in a way, you know, it's the Mediterranean and it's also the Sahara and, you know, it's the tens of thousands of other bodies of the casualties of these policies, you know, that are in such contradiction with the evolution of human history, first of all, in terms of movement, but also with our very real lived reality on the planet of the moment of so many contributed causal factors, which is going to make the amount of people seeking refuge dramatically spike in the coming years.
And it's the intersectionality spoke of. It's the fact that climate change is going, climate crisis and climate breakdown.
And resources and conflict and persecution.
Exactly. And then you have limited resources and you have a West that has hollowed
plundered.
Out. And that's how that's what we've done. Yeah. Like I remember when the EU was awarded the UN the Peace Prize. And the funny thing was that it was done that on the back of the fact that it was able to use, what is it, for every dollar that they give to the third or developing world, they were extracting 100.
Yeah.
You know, and they're the figures that we need to say. Yes, and you're right. I also like the fact that you point out that it makes us uncomfortable. We're sitting in a nice house in Glasnevin, and our kids probably will be less impacted.
Comparatively.
We could have.
But down.
If we have a biodiversity breakdown, our food supply is in danger. It really
Without
is.
A doubt.
It's very seriously in danger. But we also have the resources here that they don't have in these other areas, and we're paying other people to outsource it, similar to, I know, direct provision is kind of like a smaller window into that, but nonetheless, we are complicit. We know what's happening, and it's not even an electoral issue. You know, clearly, it's not an electoral issue.
Tony, it's not any kind of issue. That's what kind of bugs me most is that for a country like ours, with such a dreadful, dreadful history of how we treat women and children, that it's perpetuate. It goes on and it goes on and it goes on. And so many people are, you say cognitive dissonance. That's one way of putting it. I say that they're willfully ignoring it, willfully, because if you don't ignore it, you have to do something about it. So it's much easier to say, I don't see it. It's much easier to say, I don't see it, or to say, well, you know, they have it handy here anyway, or all these little tropes that come out. But the very fact is, it's women and children you are incarcerating simply for poverty, for no other reason than they don't have the same money as you. And not only are you doing that, you're paying millionaires to do it.
Yeah.
You're paying millionaires to do it. You know, if I hit you, that's bad. If I pay somebody else to hit you, that doesn't mean I've done any less harm to you. You're doing the same harm.
Yeah.
It just gets me in this country. It really, really gets me, considering, you know, what did we say? It's 20 years since the first apology and nothing, 20 years of nothing, nothing has happened. And it really irks me. It irks me of all the things that are going wrong in this country. And we do get a lot of stuff right, but that in particular, it's the biggest stain on us. It's the biggest historical stain on us. And it, people are quite happy to wear it and wear it proud. This is our stain. We'll wear it. And I just can't see that we can't change it.
I would say, to go back to what your point about, though, standing beside the younger generation, we have found, and it's been shown at every referendum over the last few years, that the people are way ahead of where the politics is. And if we could actually make these things, make it an electoral issue, it would change overnight, Martin. If it became something that if you could actually put forward a plan that was going to show everybody, including the I'm All Right Jack, that actually this would, not only would this make sense from a humanitarian sense of the point of view, it would make sense economically. It would add value to your GDP if that's what floats your boat. You would change it overnight. You would, because the argument to it is nonsensical. People should be able to contribute in a way that they feel provided for themselves, provided for their families, and for the wider society. And evidence, you know, there's not one survey that doesn't show a net plus.
The most base neoliberal arguments. And yet, but it's interesting because I think in so much of this, you know, when you look at comparative, you know, sort of systems in other contexts, you know, which, okay, they're not perfect, but they work better. I just find it such a lack of imagination as well, as if, you know, something that was supposed to be such a temporary measure that has now become so solidified and so institutionalized and, you know, so glaringly unjust and, you know, being shown up as unjust in numerous international forums, but that there is this attitude, you know, of just both complacency, but also the arrogance of power around it. And then I think that's where sort of those that profit off of it, you know, the millionaires and the specific families that profit off of it, you know, the very sort of brown envelope type mentality, you know, of a political class that is just so willing to be profoundly complicit in something, you know, I don't think it should take individual stories to change, you know, minds or change consciousnesses. But I know, like, if people, you know, who are, okay, maybe not a sort of at a, in terms of hierarchies of power at the top of that ladder, but certainly those, you know, who are living in communities that are in proximity and yet completely isolated intentionally, you know, from people living in DP contexts. But if people could see the amazing, you know, both survivors, but creativity and potentiality and like the kids in systems, like who are absolutely amazing. I think it just really put people to shame. And yet, you know, it shouldn't be about, you know, people who, you know, it should be about something much more systemic in terms of rights, you know, a rights-based narrative and not individual stories. And I think that's always sort of the contradiction that we all navigate within refugee advocacy and solidarity, you know, that we bring out individual stories to try, you know, and paint sort of that meta-narrative of, you know, broader community. And yet I think sometimes it falls into like this trope of, you know, this almost these false dichotomies painted like between sort of, you know, people that are viewed as deserving, you know, aka refugees, you know, people that are slurred, you know, and treated pejoratively as so-called economic migrants and this good, you know, migrant, bad migrant trope. So trope. So I think it's really important to have something that is more nuanced than that, but also more robust. Cause I think when we fall into that, you know, that individualization of stories, you know, and narratives within it, which is important. Storytelling is important, but then, you know, what does that miss? And what does that miss in terms of accountability when it comes to power, you know, and abdication, you know.
Think about it, under the heads of the Employment Act, you can't discriminate on all of those grounds, race, gender, sexuality, political beliefs.
But it happens all the time.
And we want to do this, and we want to turn around and say, yeah, but they weren't born here. Yeah, you know, in what world? It's either a universal declaration of human rights, or is it universalish? You know, and we let ourselves off the hook all the time by saying, well, economic migrants, as if that's actually a bad thing.
Economic migrant be a pejorative. Well, we exist
in this country because 12,000 years ago economic migrants came here. We exist. I mean, prior to that, there was nobody living on this rock. You know, the entire planet was a migrant at one stage.
Let it down, and continues to be. And it's in a state of constant flux. But I think this is, you know, and it's very much being seen in these days, like this very myopic understanding that if you militarize, if you, you know, construct these conceptual and physical borders, you know, between people, you know, that somehow you're going to stop, you know, a very natural movement, and unnatural in the sense that a lot of it is catalyzed by injustice and, you know, resource extraction and
decades where the people, on the basis that peace must be protected, which is always the thing that bothers me most, peace is peace. It doesn't need, you don't need a gun pointed at the other guy to say, I'm protecting peace. That's not how it starts, you know? And that is the basis of this, where we talk now in terms of Fortress Europe. We talk about, again, we have to mention a much bigger budget for the EU to talk about this border security, the future of Europe and PESCO. And
how little that is being invested in any sort of robust humanitarian or rights-based or people's infrastructure in terms of supporting life, rather than negating you know, people's right to seek life, and to stay alive during that journey. But in a way, I almost feel like there's so many gathering, overhanging gray clouds outside of the house today, but also, you know, geopolitically, but there's also, you know, these fissures within that. And it's partially just because, and I'm going to mention it just because I've been involved for the past while, but I think what's happening in Sudan and many other contexts in terms of these, you know, bringing in the wisdom and the intergenerational experience of sort of the elders of that movement, you know, political activists and human rights activists, but something that is extraordinarily youth driven. And in the case of Sudan, you know, in the recent massacre in Khartoum, that movement is so profoundly led by a lot of women, older women, young girls. And that's happening in the diaspora as well. Like it's very much happening in the Sudanese community in Dublin and other parts of Ireland. And so I think for all of the heaviness of, you know, the violence, the brutality, the injustice, the discrimination, the racism, the xenophobia, that huge shift, you know, and actually it was always there. Maybe shift is the wrong word, but that consolidation of those voices and that political, you know, electorate, there is also so many examples of amazing courage and hope going on. And I think when you look at, I certainly, when I've been looking at the videos coming out of Khartoum over the last few days, when you look at just that total impenetrable, you know, resilience of that spirit of people, you know, who are prepared to, you know, with such high stakes, with such extreme risk in the sense, you know, of Janjaweed or the RSF now being in control of Khartoum, but prepared to resist, prepared to dissent, and not only just to resist, I think, on the terms that oftentimes in our left we employ, you know, sort of the polemical, the raised fist, but resist with joy and community and love and art and music and creativity and, you know, really profound community. It's something that I almost feel like we don't have, you know, the right to despair or the right, you know, to throw in that towel, you know, in the sense of not seeing that hope. And in a way, I felt this in Dublin last week because I've been participating in quite a few, but there was one particular mobilization in the aftermath of the massacre of, you know, the sit-in protesters outside of the military headquarters in Khartoum in Sudan. But there was this demonstration of diaspora Sudanese, and a lot of them are medics themselves. So they're in contact with a lot of the medics who have helped organize those protests. But there was, they stood in the middle of O'Connell Street by this spire for, it turned into 6 hours of just, it was chanting and it was singing. And, you know, people were weeping and laughing and hugging each other and drums. But it was so interesting to watch the interaction, you know, with passersby, because people were accessed by it, because it had joy in it. It had life. It had emotion. It wasn't just our old polemical slogans, you know.
It wasn't angry.
It wasn't angry. There was anger, but it was anger that was channeled, you know, and expressed like through love and through grief. And even just having a glimpse, and I've seen that, like I've seen that, you know, now in Khartoum, but I participated in those moments, you know, historical moments of rupture, you know, in the status quo of oppression. I participated in Gezi Park and, you know, in Palestine and Iraq and Lebanon and in many movements in Latin America, indigenous movements. I've seen that in, you know, social movements in different contexts in the States and Canada and, you know, Europe and Ireland. And, but when you see those moments, you know, of profound joy, you know, and in that descent, it's something that not only is nurturing, but I think it almost, it gives you that fire to continue, you know, and I know I'm going to hold the memory even just of those hours of being, you know, with so many women who, like, there's a chant in Arabic, which is, what was it? Hariya salam wa adala, thawra karar al-sha'ab, you know, which means, freedom, peace, and justice. Revolution is the choice of the people. And I think our understanding of revolution has been so sort of narrowed down oftentimes just to our polemical, you know, whatever it's plastered in every poster in every public meeting. And, but revolution, you know, in the way that I understand a radical revolution, radicali, you know, when you get to the roots of something is what do we ground our, you know, our descent, if we want to call it revolutionary process within. And that soil, as I've understood it from having witnessed and walked upon, I'd say really, yeah, just effective social movements, you know, for all of my lived adult life and a lot of my child life as well, but, you know, have to be grounded in the soil of nurturing, you know, of care, of empathy, of community, of love. And I think oftentimes when you sort of, sometimes with violence, almost when those roots are removed from that soil, social movements become, you know, they close down in on themselves. And I think that sort of fracturing oftentimes that we see in the left in Ireland, I almost feel like if there was more solidarity, if there was more community, if we had more, you know, more intergenerational process, more family, you know, more fun, more creativity, more music, more art, more food, you know, more that, that somehow it would go beyond that polemical raised fist into, you know, we can raise our fists and we can open our hearts simultaneously, you know, and access people and broaden our movements. Because what those women on that street by this fire on O'Connell Street did was access people to the point that it was invitational. People felt an acceptance, you know, and to be able to participate. And I think once we can get past that sometimes self-righteous, self-judgmental, you know, sort of process that too often exists in our movements of not recognizing that everybody is on, you know, a learning curve. Everybody is evolving in our understanding, our nuance, our depth, you know, our intersectionality, our, you know, but that is a process that we all walk with, that we all grow with every single day, that it provides space where there is space for everybody, where it doesn't become exclusionary and self-righteous and dogmatic and, you know, in which it's an actual vital movement, breathing movement, living movement.
It brings us back to a much older adage than the young people. And it's nice to hear that you're so hopeful about young people, but it brings us back
and
to a much older adage is free your mind and your ass will follow, you know. But it does. If you open your mind, yeah, you know, it's easier to do these things. It's just easier. It's nice to see that. It's lovely to hear it. You have an event coming up, or you're speaking at an event on Monday. Can you tell us a little about that?
Yeah. So it's framed around safe passage, around the criminalization of search and rescue ships in the Mediterranean, the Aegean Sea. It's framed around the criminalization of solidarity and the rest of, you know, captains of crews, of volunteers who have been engaging in refugee solidarity work. And it's to try and provide platform for the narratives of some of those seeking refuge. So Sean Binder, who is an amazing young activist, campaigner, search and rescue crew member who was imprisoned in Greece for months, will be speaking at it in prison for his solidarity work. Stixi, who's an amazing organizer from Massey, who is, yeah, whenever I need hope, I hang out with Stixi because he's just got this beautiful, Leslie, this beautiful, yeah, just embracing of joy and life and positivity as well as struggle and dissent. And myself will be speaking at it, and we're going to screen short films. It's in Christchurch Cathedral.
Uh-huh, yeah.
At 7 p.m. and it's organized by the Irish Refugee Council. Oh, amazing. Hey. I think it will be small, but good, like, yeah, in the sense that, yeah.
Just, you mentioned it's been in the grassroots, been in the soil, the activism. We've seen in Ireland the movement, say, around housing, around Raise the Roof. For me, the most profound thing about Raise the Roof is that it's engaged with civil society. It's engaged, you know, you see Damien Dempsey, Francis Black, yeah. Emmett Kirwan. You see the unions involved.
Our poet philosophers. Yep.
Students.
These are the people who because that's where
big
that's,
time.
That's where it goes.
They're accessing. Yes. Yeah, and such a broader consensus. And
you
need,
and that's where change will come from. It's yeah. not going to come because Leo Varadkar decides that, you know, because let's be honest, he only decides when he's left no alternative. We've seen that with around repeal. We've seen that around how he spoke to Gene O'Kenny in the Dáil around, you know, talking to children with having epileptic attacks that need help. And he was empathy-free. And that's very disappointing for someone who's supposed to care for, he's supposed to represent the best of us. So they need to be led from the bottom up, and we need that movement. But it needs to be that intersectionality that you keep talking about. You talk about so much better than I can.
Okay.
But how we can combine those movements and see internationally why by doing right there we'll do right here, by fixing there we'll fix here, and by lifting up one we lift all. You
completely.
Know,
so understanding that our freedom is very much invested in the freedom of others.
Exactly.
You know, and to broaden that understanding of like what does freedom mean, and does freedom, you know, if we're living in a context in a historical moment where we're witnessing oppression, you know, on our streets, but we're also witnessing oppression in so many different geographical contexts. If we don't respond, if there isn't that onus and impetus to respond, to be active, you know, I think we become complicit, you yeah. know, in systems of oppression. And if we can feel that personal responsibility, not in a way that weighs down to the point of being overwhelmed, but that really energizes, you know, and creates hope in what solidarity can mean, what internationalism can mean, what intersectional struggle can mean, you know, it can be something beautiful. Like,
yeah. Yeah.
But the real problem seems to be to move the center, to to realign the center. I don't mean
yeah.
to realign yeah, yeah. the center. The center allows this to exist. The center accepts this uncompromising compromise.
Yeah.
And it's how do you shift the center? How do you, it is the children of centrists who are now more a driver than the centrists themselves, which is very telling. It
yeah.
is very, very telling
yeah.
that it's the kids of centrists
oh, totally.
Who are far more radical than the centrists
yeah.
themselves.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And I think maybe, and it's not to answer the question because I have no answer, but I think in a way there is an answer within that, in the sense, you know, that nothing is static and
yeah.
there is always that potential, you know, for change. And I think, you know, because of climate crisis, because of that overhanging, overwhelming anxiety that a lot of children find around that, I think that can be a segue into understanding, you know, social justice within climate, human rights within climate crisis, you know, and being able to look past plastic straws, you know,
yeah.
into
mm-hmm. yeah.
systematic, yes. you know, fundamental system
yeah.
change,
yeah.
you know, and within that personal lifestyle choices are important, but not at the negation, you know, of governmental, of corporate, you know, et cetera, responsibility. And also, you know, within that, you know, that our personal choices. And I think this is a real challenge for educators. Like, how do you expand what is great? You know, the whole sort of SDG narrative, that's great, but not if you're not talking about radical fundamental change within that, not if you're not talking about injustice within that, and not if you're not bringing in, you know, that international perspective in a much realer way, you know, like who, yeah, 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 and building that empathy. And I think the children have it in a much deeper, you know, much more profound way than their parents certainly do. I mean, they're bringing their parents along with them. And
yes.
I that's beautiful. Like I go into grocery shops and I overhear conversations between children and their parents. And yeah, it starts with plastic packaging, but that is a stepping stone into, you know, the broader currents of understanding. Yeah, just rights in the world.
Well, I think it's lovely to see how optimistic you are.
But you
come across as so optimistic. And in the face of such problems, that's really lovely to see that you stayed optimistic throughout. I mean, a lot of people get very cynical. I could say I get very cynical. But you have stayed optimistic. It's great. It's a great testament to you that you have.
I have to, you know, I am, I think by nature an optimistic person, but it's also, I think in a way, like I've witnessed so much death, death of friends, death of comrades, you know, violent death. I've lived through wars, you know, as a volunteer and worked, you know, on ambulances as a volunteer medic. And, you know, so I've seen, I think, humanity at its very worst and most brutal and most violent and painful. Like I've witnessed massacres and their aftermath. And I think what has kept me, you know, alive and hopeful is that I've also seen in the most devastating of contexts, you know, of war, you know, profound humanity and love and empathy and community. And so my optimism, its roots, you know, is in that memory. But I think oftentimes, and I know a lot of people who have navigated, you know, health, precarity and mortality as well. When you witness your own mortality, when you witness, you know, the really, yeah, just the precarity of our own lives, our own physical lives, it just opens you up, I think, spiritually in a way to, yeah, just to a broader understanding of the necessity with the life that's left in our physical bodies, you know, to really fight, you know, for the rights of people, you know, oftentimes whose rights are so deeply negated. But within that, also to recognize that in that fight and in that struggle, there is so much joy, you know, and I can't imagine living in any other way. I can't imagine living in a way in which, you know, that the meaning in a way that that struggle has given me. And it's been a luxury in my own life that I've been able to participate in so many, you know, movements, social justice movements of people who have given me such inspiration and hope. But I can't imagine living in another way. And I think it's that thing around mortality, but also once you've witnessed, you know, you can't unsee what you've seen, you can't unsee. And to honor those memories of deep loss and pain, you know, that I witnessed in my own personal life, but to honor the memories of people that I've known and also many strangers, you know, whose bodies we recovered, you know, broken, desecrated bodies of families, and but almost to honor their memory through trying to create the conditions that nobody else, you know, and I know that sounds overly optimistic. Of course, war will continue, but that as much as we can, you know, we can try and protect, you know, and accompany and stand by those who are struggling, you know, for their human rights, for basic rights, for freedom, for liberation, and much more. You know, it's more than just, you know, struggling against oppression. It's struggling for the communities and the lives that we want, you know, in which everybody can live with dignity and power, you know, and power in it. It's most just, you know, life enhancing version, you know, power that is divorced from domination, you know, power that is empowering and yeah. And that is life giving.
Well, thank you so much for coming in to talk to us. I think that's the perfect point to leave it. I think that is the perfect. I'm glad that there are people like you in the world. I am glad that there are people like you in the world.
Likewise.
No, really. I hope everybody gets as much from that as we have. I'm in awe of the stuff you've done. I know we didn't go into it and I understand why we didn't go into it, but you are an astounding human being and a top class person. And you know what? Oh. Thank you for the work you do. It's really great. Guys, it's on Eventbrite. We'll put out the link for the event on Monday. We'll add a few links to other things that are coming up, but like, you know, check out Cuiva on Twitter, follow Massey as well, look at the work that the guys are doing, support them. You got to make it an issue and we can all come together. I suppose the main thing we get here is there is hope.
Thanks, Tony.
Big time.
Take care.
Thank you.
Thank you.